Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. This week, something slightly different. An episode first published on the new Xterra podcast, hosted by our friends Dr. Simon Marshall and Leslie Patterson. If you haven't done so already, you might want to take a moment to add the new Xterra podcast in your app. In particular, I would like to draw your attention to the second episode, where they talk to experts about how to cope with COVID-19 and share their own stories of dealing with uncertainty, the good and bad of social media, and how the concept of structure, routine, and reward can help. Back to the episode you're about to hear. If you're an endurance athlete and complain of fatigue, insomnia, hormone problems, anxiety, depression, bloating, or other gut issues, you're not alone. In this episode of the Xterra podcast, 5-time off-road triathlon world champion Leslie Patterson and her husband, sports psychologist Dr. Simon Marshall, talk about their own struggle journey through the aforementioned health issues and share what they've learned along the way. Just before we get into this week's interview with Simon and Les, I would like to extend thanks to the kind folk who support Nourish Balance Thrive on Patreon for helping to make this content possible. Supporting us on Patreon comes with perks, including access to our expert moderated forum. Each week, our scientific director, Megan Hall, takes questions from the forum and answers them in a live office hour session on Zoom. Last week in office hours, Megan answered your questions on lactulose as a prebiotic, laxative and detoxifying agent, the best blue blocking glasses, the bioavailability of powdered protein supplements, reducing high copper levels, the Food Marble Air Digestive Breath Analyzer, taurine supplementation for muscle and bone health, and finally and most importantly, Megan's new Labrador puppy, Cooper. If you search for office hours on the forum, you'll find the link to the video replay together with excellent notes, including all the citations and pictures of Cooper. If you currently don't have access to the forum, consider supporting Nourish Balance Thrive on Patreon. If, like me, you're currently out walking the dogs or riding your bike just now, I'll email you later this week with a link to support us on Patreon. If you're not already receiving the podcast show notes by email from me, open a browser and go to mbt.link and you can sign up there. Thanks again for your support. Now over to this week's interview with Dr. Simon Marshall and Leslie Patterson.
So, and tough shit for us, it's another gorgeous day in San Diego. And I am sporting the best farmer's tan ever known to man.
You don't often have a cycling tan on your arms.
No.
Because swimming, you can't
swim outside, don't I? So I get like an all-over body tan.
So you've really got a combine harvester.
I look ridiculous. Yep. Total ridiculous. Anyways, but I was out today in the mountains on the bike. It was amazing. And I have so much gratitude.
You've said you're feeling good at the moment. So
I am feeling good, but whenever I do feel good and I can get outside and I am not in pain, and we'll get into that in a moment, I have a lot of gratitude for that because I truly love what I do as an athlete and as a professional. But I've had a lot of years really, really struggling with my health and with injuries. And it's taken a toll on both me and on you too.
I've run out of rolls of duct tape.
Yeah. So pretty much after 2012, when I won my second world title in Maui, I think the pressure got to me and I took it too far, trained too hard, got too skinny, the body fell apart, and I found out I also had chronic Lyme disease. And basically, it was like this cascade of events that meant that really my body couldn't function anymore at all, right?
And it became not just about now performing and training, but a whole ton of other things.
Living life.
Yeah, life, like your fertility, your hormone levels in general.
Joyfulness, happiness.
Joyfulness, yeah, mental health.
Yep.
So, and when it goes beyond impacting your sport, then it's a bit of a bigger wake-up call. And that's actually a good way to talk about our guest this week, Chris Kelly, because Chris Kelly is British. He lives in Santa Cruz and he owns a clinic called Nourish Balance Thrive. And he focuses on fixing athletes like Leslie, those that have chronic diseases or illnesses brought on by either infection and or overtraining, but really geared towards helping athletes using some sort of fairly forensic biomedical testing and then figuring out a plan of action. And so you went to him because you were exasperated.
Exasperated with what I was going through. And this is, in fact, we talk in our book about my health hustle. I used all of that energy that I would normally put into training and excelling as an athlete into figuring out what was wrong with me, why, and the solutions to that, which involved a lot of different testing, working with a lot of different doctors, and finding people like Chris to really dig deeper.
Welcome to the Xterra podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Simon Marshall, a performance psychologist, and I'm here with my co-host and pint-sized wife, Leslie Patterson, a professional triathlete with 5 world titles to her name.
Hey, wait a minute. How come you get to do the intro?
Well, it's just that you're kind of hard to understand sometimes.
What, because I'm Scottish?
Well, yeah, sort of.
That is so typical of the bloody English. Oh, whatever, man. So wherever you're from, if you're a fan of outdoor, endurance, adventure sports, you've come to the right place. We talk everything from training your body and mind for outdoor shenanigans to gear, expeditions, travel and culture.
Let's get started.
Well, after our Braveheart Highland Games and living with a professional athlete, it's interesting to see both the light and dark sides of the sports that we're involved with. People who are, you know, you see people battered after a long training camp or continuously injured. And we deal with this obviously a lot in our coaching. And that brings me to our guest this month, which is Chris Kelly, the owner and founder of Nourish Balance Thrive, a functional medicine clinic in Santa Cruz, California, a virtual clinic, and a professional mountain biker, and who suffered with gut problems for many years, or just didn't feel his usual self. And I think his attempts to try and fix himself down the conventional routes weren't working for him. And hence he founded a company designed to help primarily athletes who feel a bit broken in some shape. Not psychologically broken, but physically broken. And then Leslie, you became a client of MBT and Chris.
I did. I got to meet Chris and understand what it is that he does. And I found the world of functional medicine, which I think we kind of want to jump in and talk about as well, because most people out there don't even know what functional medicine is. I think there's a lot of people out there, a lot of athletes that we speak to, athletes that we coach, and people out there in the world that don't feel as good as they want to, and they don't know why. They want to go out and they want to be adventurers. They want to participate in the sport competitively or otherwise, but they're maybe not feeling great, or they've pushed themselves so hard to excel in what it is that they do that they now don't feel good, right? So Chris, I just kind of wanted to talk to you a little bit about your background, how you found NBT, and yeah, some of the things you're finding in athletes and some of your knowledge behind that.
Sure, yeah. I guess I've always been...
Wait, you're English? Oh my God. Did you know that Eve's going to be English?
I didn't. I thought he was Scottish. He's been lying to us all this time.
Half Scottish. My dad's Scottish.
That's why you're so weird. Oh no, hang on. That's why you're so good looking and witty.
Yeah, that's right. That's why my teeth are so great. Yeah, I've always been an outdoor lover, and that's why I came to the US actually. That was the promise, was that somebody was going to let me work during the week and then go snowboarding at the weekend. And once I came to San Francisco, I got into kiteboarding and more mountain biking. Mountain biking was my original thing, actually, in Wales. You remember when you used to go riding? Oof. It would rain every time you went riding. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Now we live in California. You don't ride when it rains, right? Like, they actually put up signs saying, please don't ride when it's raining. I'm like, what the fuck?
Well, you don't even ride here if there are grey skies. That's right. It's the anticipation of rain that keeps people away here.
Yeah, but I got into it. I started getting competitive. Have you ever done that?
It's
just a desperate trap. Yeah, don't ever do that. And it really started, I remember I was doing a ski lease with a friend, and I was mountain biking at Tamarancho, which is in Marin in California. And this friend thought I was going to suck, and he was trying to sort of push me away. We just ran into each other in the car park, and he was like, no, I don't think I want to ride with you, mate. No, I don't, you know, because he thought I was going to hold him up. And then I did nothing of the sort. And at the end, he sort of came round and warmed me. He's like, wow, you're pretty good. You should come to a bike race with me this weekend. So I did. And he was right. I was quite strong. I did really well, quite easily. And then, of course, you think, well, shit, what, you know, I'm just screwing around here. Like, I haven't even done any training or anything. Like, what is possible? And you hire a coach, and they tell you to do all this stuff. And what to eat. And, you know, I was just following the conventional advice, maltodextrin gels and all of that. Remember?
Yep, ditto. I'm right there with you.
Yeah. And so before I knew it, I was doing 20 hours a week of training, which I know is nothing for you, Les, but wow. I mean, it's quite a lot for a mountain biker, I think. Mm-hmm. And just eating more of the same diet I'd always ate, which is the cardiologist diet, I call it, you know, like super low fat, high carb, a lot of pasta, a lot of bread, a lot of cereal. And I couldn't sleep through the night. I'd wake up in the middle of the night, starving, hungry, and have to eat breakfast in the middle of the night. And then you get the postprandial slumber, you know, when you feel really tired after eating a high carb meal. And I think most people listening to this will know that, right? Yeah, that's what people eat for lunch. Like, why do you think the Spanish have a siesta?
Right.
Yeah. I don't think it's because it's too hot, right? It's too hot in a lot of different countries. But for some reason, the Spanish take a nap after lunch.
They're just lazy. No, I should say that.
Maybe they...
sensible.
Or exactly, they figured out how to live a meaningful life. But yeah, so I started developing a ton of symptoms. Insomnia was one of them, but then also a lot of brain fog. I was working as a computer programmer for a tech company and I just couldn't work anymore. I just couldn't really think straight. And luckily I never really got found out. Have you ever had that experience where you feel like you're going to get found out? Someone's going to realize that you've not been doing any work for a long time. And it never happens, surprisingly. But the weird thing is that the thing I was still able to do was train. Like even with all these health problems, insomnia, fatigue, tons of GI problems, I was still able to train. And I realized that was one of the few times that I felt good. Have you ever had that? You're like, you don't look forward to the session and it sucks for the first 15 minutes. Or sometimes, I think towards the end, actually, it was sucked for the first hour. It took me an hour to warm up to really start to feel good. And then I'd feel really good for a couple of hours, maybe 3 or 4 hours on the bike. And then you just eat and eat and eat and eat and eat. And then you'd feel terrible again, like the next day, you know? And so you just repeat the cycle. But yeah, I mean, I got good results. So eventually, I mean, I had to figure out my health issues and fix a bunch of physiological problems before I finally got my pro license on the mountain bike.
What kind of physiological problems did you discover?
So after I cleaned up my act, so I got really lucky. I discovered the Paleo Diet for Athletes by Joel Friel. And of course, you know, and Lauren Cordain, which is like one of the researchers on the Paleo Diet, TM. And that book really helped me. It wasn't the whole answer, but it definitely got me started in the right direction. And then after I'd gone in that direction, I met the woman who is now my wife. And she'd recently been studying food allergies in the lab, right? So she'd been doing nutritional sciences for her master's degree. And she was the one that kind of created a well-formulated paleo diet, right? That wasn't just, you know, ditch all the pasta and the bread and the cereal and then just eat tons and tons of eggs and nuts. You know, that's really the diet that I constructed, right? I was trying to be vegetarian on top of everything. It was just a complete disaster. So she reformulated my diet, cooked all the food, and all I did was eat. And that sounds like a fantastic relationship.
She's
amazing.
Don't have access to that. But what's fascinating though is, okay, so a lot of people don't understand why paleo is important or effective or why you would jump on that.
Right.
Why is diet even effective?
Right.
Why is your gut important? You know, people don't know the basics of that.
Right. I don't think it needs to be complicated, actually. I think that's one of the things I've learned over the last 6 years of running MBT and working with clients and recording the podcast and whatnot, is that in the beginning, I thought it did need to be complicated and you need to like measure things and know how much of vitamins and minerals and whatnot is in all your food. But now I don't think that's true. I think that you just need to put your hypothalamus in an environment that allows it to regulate food intake. The problem is that most of the foods that we're exposed to has been engineered like to within an inch of its life, specifically for the purpose of making you eat more, right? So think about Pringles. They're literally so good, you can't stop, right? And so that's the problem. You end up eating a significant proportion of your food intake is coming from these highly processed foods that don't really bring much to the table in the way of micronutrients. And now I don't think about it at all. We just eat a minimally processed diet that doesn't consist of a bunch of highly refined foods. And then there's specific things that I think that's super toxic to everyone, like seed oil, soybean oil and whatnot. Like if you can just avoid those things and just let your brain take care of the rest, like it works.
But why is it bad for you? I mean, I think people don't really understand the basics of, you know, the food that we put in our system, processed right. foods versus not. Like, what does it do to your system? What right. is it doing to your gut? You know, just a kind of overview of that, because I right. think at that most basic level, people don't even understand.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think so. Some of the refined carbohydrates, I think, are really no bueno. Like the maltodextrin in particular, I think is really good at creating a dysbiotic environment in the gut. you know. So you've got these bacteria in your gut that do good things for you, and they keep out pathogens and all kinds of fun. I'm sure most people listening to this have heard of the human gut microbiome by this point, right? It's super important.
Maybe not. A lot of people don't even know that stuff yet.
Right.
I mean, educated people, you know, that we coach, people that I'm interacting with that have high-end jobs, right. They haven't put two and two together.
They haven't heard of the gut microbiome.
No.
I mean, this is just a general principle in nature. Wherever there are resources, there'll be something there eating them, right? Like you can go down to the microscopic level and there'll always be something there using unused resources. And so that's what's happening in the gut is there's, you know, a bunch of resources in there, right? And so there's going to be organisms there that are consuming those resources. And some of them do really useful things for us. So it's mostly bacteria, but then there's also, you know, fungi and viruses and all kinds of good stuff in there. And the food that you eat is going to have a huge impact in the ecology of those microorganisms that are present in the gut. And of course, there's lots of things that influence that, including exercise, including how you were born, were you born vaginally or were you born by C-section, antibiotics use both in early life and then later on in life. All those things are going to have an impact, you know, but it seems like almost nothing doesn't have an impact at this point, right? Like I'm sure you've seen some of the studies like such and such changes the human gut microbiome and whatnot. But I think some of the things that athletes do, particularly the overconsumption of refined carbohydrates, especially maltodextrin, which is the sugar that you find in most of these sports products. So I've gotten to the point where I was slamming down one of those squeezy gel things every 40 minutes. And if I didn't have that, I would start to experience what I would call hypoglycemic symptoms. So I'd start to feel tired, dizzy, super hungry, felt like I couldn't go on until I had another one of the squeezy gels. So I was consuming vast amounts of this stuff, right? If I'm doing 20 hours a week of training, then one gel every 40 minutes, that's a lot of gel, right? Like, I mean, that's going to make a big difference to the gut microbiome. And I think that's going to affect the integrity of the gut lining, right? So you think about it from your mouth to Uranus is really it's a tube that's complete. And the inside is really the outside of your body still, right? Like you're trying to keep things that are foreign on the outside. And if something happens to the integrity of that gut wall, the epithelial cells that line that gut wall, then stuff that's supposed to be on the outside is going to start to get on the inside. And that causes them problems, right? It's like having an infection. So you got to look after that lining of the gut, and it's hard.
But I think people get into this sport because they love the outdoors, they love the primal aspects of getting out there, it feels healthy, and they don't realize that pushing their bodies that hard, consuming these types of food is bad for them. They've not really dug deep, they don't know how good or bad they feel. I think we're in a world now where, oh, I'm just getting old, or, oh, I must just be tired, or,
Everybody's just affected, stressed. Right.
And so, you know, certainly from my experience, right, I came into the sport as a youngster. I pushed pretty hard from a very young age. And Simon would definitely jump in and say that I'm pretty much addicted to exercise. And I've pushed my body to such extremes. I mean, I'm at the other end of the spectrum that I created a whole host of awful, awful health issues. Couple that with sort of not understanding the role of diet, not understanding the role of toxicity in our environment, all of these kinds of things. I've kind of really been to hell and back with this. And I think that a lot of people now are dealing with elements of this in their life. They certainly get into this sport thinking it's going to be healthy for them. They kind of jump down the rabbit hole of that sort of need for more. And then they don't understand how they feel anymore, and they don't probably educate themselves as to the symptoms, why they're feeling that way, and what does that actually mean?
Yeah, it's really hard, isn't it? I think that's maybe one of the key lessons is noticing how this is making you feel, right? And it's tough because you can be like a frog boiling in water, right? You don't necessarily, it's really only when something goes away or changes very quickly do you notice the change. It's really, really tough. And then of course you go see your primary care doctor and you describe some of your symptoms and they say, well, that's just completely normal. You're an athlete. These things happen to athletes. And so now you've just had someone in a position of authority tell you that actually this is just what happens and this is to be expected, but you don't really want to give up the sport. So then you just put up with it and the problem never gets solved.
because the thing that we love is to be out there, to be doing it with other people. And the thing that we need to do often is to pull back from that and have some more rest and recovery and find the right diet and build ourselves up again to be able to come back and do it. And that's one of the hardest things in the world. And I mean, Si's lived with me.
But to be the slight contrarian here is that, so if you as you discussed, Chris, doing 20 hours of week of training and you were pounding gels and Leslie doing that and plus some, doctors saying, well, yes, okay, it's perfectly normal, and or the human body wasn't really designed to do that much, these extreme endurance training. And we can get into the weeds about whether that's
whether or not as a designer.
No. And so the things that you're talking about, gut permeability or GI distress or something, are also an artifact of the behaviors that you're doing. So yes, we can try and fix diet, but maybe don't do as much of that stuff because the body was not designed to do that in the way that you're doing it.
Right. And one of the things that we consistently see with clients is they've already admitted that and then they've stopped completely. I got to the point where I realized, okay, this is crazy. I just need to stop.
Yeah.
And they stop completely and the symptoms don't really go away.
Right.
And then you're like, okay, I'm still scratching my head here. What's going on? And I think in that regard, I was very lucky because I didn't really stop. And that was one of the reasons I started MBT, is because if you went to see anyone else, like any of the, well-known, if you type functional medicine into Google and then you find a bunch of doctors, if you go and see any of them and you're doing 20 hours a week of exercise, the first thing they're going to tell you to do, stop it. You're not going to be able to recover until you stop doing this. And we know it's not true. Like, you don't need to stop completely or even have people stop. I mean, we're working with Olympic athletes or other professionals. You can't tell them, oh, you just need to stop it, right? Like, that's just not an option. And so you just have to pull every lever that's available to you, but that's not one of them.
So, I mean, what's the first thing that you do when you're with a client? So they come to the table with, talk about a little bit of, the symptoms that they have and then the sort of step-by-step. What do
strategy.
You do with them?
The strategy. I think that our neurologist, Josh, has been super good at solidifying what is the strategy. Like, it would all be this. I mean, it's not like it was a huge change when Josh started talking about this, but it really helped sort of codify what it was that we're doing. And, so he has this four quadrant model that prioritizes therapeutic interventions. So the first thing that we're going to do is, so the history is so important and quite often, I think, overlooked. But, minimizing environmental mismatch, I think, is the first thing that we always do and that everybody should be doing. I don't think there's any exceptions to this rule. So you think for millions of years, humans and their ancestors have been walking around upright, bipedal, under the same sun, light, dark cycles. And, that's shaped our biology in very specific ways. We're very well adapted to our environments. And yet, if you look over the last even 50 years, there's things that just didn't exist 50 years ago, right? Like DoorDash wasn't a thing like 5 years ago, right?
Yeah. Love that.
This is crazy, right? So, minimizing environmental mismatch. So what are the things? When you think, Simon, you've been really good. Or what are the things? What are the things that people need to worry about first with health or performance? And I think the SEEDS framework is super good for that, right?
Well, I think the SEEDS. So we started in my work in health coaching and working actually with some stuff with you, Chris, is laying down some sort of small, manageable behavioral things that you can do around exercise and stress and sleep and so on. So has that started to become sort of, the starting point? Okay, let's look at what you are currently doing with regard to stress management, sleep, exercise, diet. Are there low-hanging fruit there about, getting you to have a better quality sleep, having good sleep hygiene, or the timing of what you eat and when you eat, or the fact that you're using you need to use emotional and task focused coping strategies and so on. And so those behavioral things, but athletes that come to you, they're usually coming with a physical complaint, aren't they? That I have chronic diarrhea when I'm racing or I'm currently bloated. Yeah. I'm bloated all the time.
Exhausted, tired. Brain fog. Right. What are some of the classic symptoms so that, people that are listening to this can be like, oh, light bulb moment. Yep. I feel that and that.
Yeah, definitely. I think nearly every single athlete that we work with has got some degree of gut dysfunction. And it's usually diarrhea, I want to say. That was my bias too, but there's quite often constipation too. And then the worst is when you get both, you get people that alternate between the two. And sometimes it feels like There's diarrhea, water that's actually forcing its way past compacted stools. So you're sort of alternating toward between constipation and diarrhea. It's like really, I mean, you know this, Les, like you've been through some of these things. So it's really fucking terrible. And then the bloating, like I would, ruin a bike ride is.
It ruins your life. It's so uncomfortable.
Yeah, and I think I still have some, it's been about 6 years since I've been fixed, but I think I still have some like postural stuff even, you know, yes. Like I'm used to sort of hunching over. I'll sit down.
Ditto.
Doing a lot of this because that would be the position.
Most comfortable.
That would relieve the pressure. So you're just so bloated. And then even like physical intimate stuff with my, you know, I don't like people touching my belly because it's like, that just didn't, I didn't want you to, but so it's pretty awful, like gut stuff. I think it really can ruin your life.
What about anxiety and depression? I mean, are you finding clients that have quite a lot of that or?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, again, it's like we do the same standardized health assessment questionnaire we've been doing for 5 years. And there are questions in that area. And yeah, absolutely. I think every single athlete is experiencing some degree of anxiety and depression. And certainly I saw that in myself that, once I always thought I was an introverted back office programmer and, you know, a successful day for me meant as fewer interactions as I could have with other humans as possible. And when somebody called me, I mean, I never used to be quite this bad. You know, when I lived in London, I was obviously more sociable. I mean, I think it's harder to be in, you know, or maybe you can be completely isolated, a hermit living in London. But I feel like I was definitely more sociable earlier on in my life. But then I got to the point where people would call me. And I would deliberately not answer the phone, you know, because like, I didn't want to go out and get dinner. I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to leave the house. Nothing seemed like fun to me anymore. And so, yeah, when you fix all this stuff, I start looking forward to training again. I start feeling like interacting with other people. And, you know, now we're talking about living with another family, which would mean a lot of interaction with other humans. And that would have been unthinkable to me. Even five years ago would have been, I just couldn't have been able to hang with that, you know? And so now I realize that probably what I thought, you know, you might say, well, that's just how you are. You're just introverted. You're just, you know, just don't, you know, you like time alone. Well, I think that maybe is like a pathology. I mean, you think about it, even 10,000 years ago, you would have been part of a tribe, and to be cast out from the tribe would be a death sentence. You just simply wouldn't be able to survive without the others, the rest of your tribe. And so how does it make sense that you'd be the sort of person that needs to spend a lot of time alone? Like that just doesn't make any evolutionary sense to me whatsoever.
But I think we've labeled a lot of these things, as normal and acceptable. And as you say, you go and see your GP and you're maybe given a pill for...
Yeah, they reach straight for... Yeah, so going back to Josh's four-quadrant model, you've got things that minimize environmental mismatch, and then you've got some other things that perhaps disrupt the physiology in some evolutionarily appropriate way. And so lifting weights would be a really good example of that. Psychotherapy would be another really good example of that. And then you kind of dip below that into the next sort of layer of things, and those are like the source code level interventions. And I think a lot of the functional medicine stuff belongs in this realm, right? I measured your blood level of methylmalonic acid and it's elevated and I think you have a vitamin B12 deficiency. Therefore, we should adjust your diet to get more of that, or maybe you should take a supplement. And then you go beyond that and you've got the things that are both disruptive and source code level, which is basically all pharmaceuticals, right? And so, you know, that's the toolkit that the primary care doctor has. They're going to go straight to quadrant four. When you walk in, they're not going to really make any attempt to understand whether your current environment is mismatched from what would be appropriate for you. And sometimes it works. Like, so for example, one of my worst symptoms, the thing that really got me to go to the doctor was erectile dysfunction. I got kicked off of some girl's doorstep because I couldn't get it up, literally. And so I went to the doctor and he gave me Viagra, which is fucking great. Like, I don't know if you're, it really works well.
Yeah.
But does it do anything to address the underlying process that caused my symptoms in the first place? No, it doesn't. And what else might be going on? You know, like you have to question, I mean, cardiovascular disease is still the number one killer in the US. And, you know, if the plumbing's not working properly and increasing nitric oxide through Viagra is allowing you to get an erection, you have to question the health of the rest of the endothelium as well. Like, and that's cardiovascular disease is unhealthy endothelium. So it's like kind of a, you know, danger, Will Robinson. There's something going on here. The engine check light's on.
Right.
You can't just take a pill and expect it to fix it. Like, you have to understand the process.
But just coming back to this notion or the centrality of the role of the gut in health, physical and mental health. So in the last, and this is, might be a tough question to put you on the spot like this, but in the last sort of 5 or 10 years, what are some of the scientific findings that are really forcing us into us being, you know, the sort of the medical, the scientific community to reevaluate about our medical textbooks being rewritten because of now what we're understanding about the gut microbiome or what's happening in the gut or the role of the gut in mental health or the role of gut in immune function or the role of gut inflammation.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That's the problem with the way that medicine is taught, right? It's like decades before any of this stuff trickles down into medical textbooks, and maybe that's part of the problem.
Well, so I'm not talking about necessarily medical education, but certainly in, you know, there's a paper written in it that's, you know, on all of public health students and probably maybe medical students as well should read. And it looks at the life cycle of scientific ideas translating into clinical practice. And it's about 17 years it takes from an idea being spawned, like let's write a grant to try and study this a little bit more. And then the grant gets funded. You do the study, you write it up, you publish it. You have to then have a critical mass of studies to build a weight of evidence to then influence clinical practice. That process takes a long time. But medical education, to be fair, has changed in the last sort of 10 years or so. So they are able to respond a lot sooner and quicker to more contemporary issues in medicine. The difficulty is what translates actually into practice. So whether that is not just prescriptions or pharmaceuticals, but also what things, for example, when you look at what physical activity recommendations are or movement and diet recommendations are, the way that exercise and diet is taught in medicine is still lags behind the scientific evidence quite considerably. Yeah, there is a lag. That's just the kind of the reason for that is also protective. You can't start to pivot and change clinical practice on the basis of single studies.
Right.
So you have to build up, you have to accumulate a wealth of evidence over time.
I think what I'm actually quite interested in is primal health and the notion of that. Like, what does that mean? We hear that buzz phrase a bunch. And I think a lot of people, again, that are out there active in the environment, they love to go run and hike and all the rest of it. They feel that primal urge. Like, what does that even mean?
Well, I think it's like, I mean, it's harking back to Josh's four quadrant model, really, isn't it? It's like, I mean, what other lens? I mean, you have to look at things through the lens of evolution. Like, what other lens is there? How can you look at biology through any other lens, right? Like, you know that this thing has been, I mean, Simon used that word designed, which is kind of there isn't a designer, but the system has been designed in a sense with descent through modification, and it changes fairly slowly, and culture can change very quickly, but our biology doesn't change very quickly at all. And 10,000, you know, we were at the San Diego Zoo yesterday, and they were showing what life was like 12,000 years ago in Southern California. And there's all these incredible megafauna, you know, like big cats with huge teeth and mammoths that are like a woolly mammoth, but no fur, you know, it's just like a really big elephant. And you're like, wow, that's incredible. That's only 12,000 years ago. That's like a blink of an eye, right? Like, even, you know, I mean, there's been anatomically modern humans for at least 200,000 years, probably more. So you could take a human from 200,000 years ago, put a pair of jeans on them, and they could walk down the street in LA and you wouldn't know that was, you know, an ancient human. Like, I think, you know, our biology just does not change that much in that amount of time. So it's not surprising that we have urges to similar to the ones that presumably even modern hunter-gatherers have too. So you can like look at those people, look at the Hadza, look at the Matisse and all these other modern hunter-gatherers and see how they live. Like, that's probably, those are pretty much baked into the system, right? Like, those urges, wants and needs and desires.
You know, it feels like we're getting away from a lot of given sort of our current environments. How is that, you know, bad for our bodies, and why is there a drive to kind of get back to the essence of this primal health?
Have we engineered it too good?
Right? You know?
Yeah, I think we have, haven't we? Is there a cost of that? DoorDash is a really good example, right? There's this thing called optimum foraging strategy where all animals will try and acquire the most number of calories whilst it's spending the fewest calories. And that's a highly evolved and conserved behavior in most because it allowed you to pass more of your DNA into the future, right? Like, oh, you found the thing with all the calories. Great. Travel the least amount of distance to find that. And of course, now there's DoorDash and you can deliver, you know, all the 40 million calories to raise a baby to adulthood. You can have them all delivered in one afternoon just like by calling this number, right? And so, you know, is there going to be a cost of that? And indeed, that's what we see is, you know, diseases of mismatch where obesity is the norm.
But evolution isn't static. It's a dynamic process. So surely we can argue about whether the merits of the DoorDash or that type of service. But we will genetically adapt to the environment as well again, right? And so I don't think that there's ever... This is why I've always struggled with ancestral... You know, we've had this discussion a little bit with ancestral health, about looking back to see what we should be doing.
But how long does that take? I mean, even very simple adaptation. So lactose tolerance is a good example, right? That is a thing, right? You do have people that can consume milk into adulthood and there's no problem with that. However, that's a really simple change. Like everybody has lactose tolerance in the beginning. And so all you've really done is prevent something from going away. And even that, it's like not everybody is lactose tolerant, right? Like lactose intolerance is still a very common thing. And unless you're from Northern European ancestry, the chances are you aren't lactose tolerant. You can't drink milk in adulthood. And so that's the point, is that, you know, these cultural changes happen so quickly.
And then
But the biological changes are much slower.
So is this one of the reasons behind, for example, the surge in allergies or children or nut allergies?
Yeah, because we get a lot of athletes with asthma that they've never had before, a lot of breathing problems. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, there's definitely some evidence that early life exposures sort of tames the immune system, right? Like you just... You know, in the absence of something useful to do, the immune system gets busy with something you would really rather it wouldn't. So asthma and allergies is a really good example of that. So I think there's even some data, you know, children that grew up with exposure to animals early in life have lower incidence of asthma and allergies later in life. And then some other stuff like H. pylori is generally considered to be a pathogen, but having H. pylori earlier in life means you're less likely to get these immune dysfunctions later in life. So it's possible that the culture of hand sanitizers and, you know, the disinfectant spray cleaners and, you know, all of this super sterile stuff has had a negative impact in the long run for the gut microbiome and therefore immunity.
So we got the wonderful chance to come and visit you in your house. And what was really cool was to see how you and your wife, Julie, have kind of changed and adapted your life to encompass some of the positive things in terms of whether it's social communities, you know,
artificial light.
Yeah, how you sleep together or cohabitation, your diet. Just walk me through some of those things, because it's pretty wild some of the changes that you've made in your life from living in London. I mean, you were in finance, right? And then jumping into this world up in Santa Cruz where it's like, you know, you shut down your Wi-Fi, you only have us, you know. Talk through some of that stuff, because I'm fascinated by it.
Well, I think Simon, you've been instrumental here in, like, it's not one big change, right? It's like very small, tiny changes that compound over the time. And so if you were to walk into my living room now, you'd think, whoa, this is like way too different from anything I could ever achieve. But yeah, those changes have been very slow and incremental over time. And we're not using a bunch of high order reasoning, right? Like to think about, it's just all habitual. You know, I'm very jealous of my wife has what I might call a subterranean neural network that allows her to do the shopping in our local hippie supermarket without using any high order reasoning whatsoever. She just like does it all on autopilot and she blows her friends' minds. Like they see how quickly she gets the shopping done and how much like good stuff she's got in there. Like no one can understand how she does it. But the reason she's doing it is because it's all on autopilot, right? Like she's done it so many times. It's just habitual. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's that the light environment Simon touched on there, I think is really important. And I've just been learning that lesson again when staying with some friends in San Diego, that I just cannot hang with artificial light at night. You know, when I go somewhere else, I think, you know what, screw it. I'm not going to worry about that. And then sure enough, 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm wide awake. Like it's, oh crap, really? Like, but so I guess for me, the main reason I keep doing it is because there's that quite strong negative feedback when I don't do it. And that constantly reminds me. And then again, it's like noticing, oh, you didn't sleep very well last night. Or why is that? You know, it's not just normal. Like, you know, you normally sleep well. So pay attention to that. Like, why might that be?
So what if you were talking to, well, so our audience and in fact us, what are some things, given the lifestyles of the most of our audience for this podcast, people are interested in, either do, you know, endurance activities of some description, they outdoorsy. What kinds of things could we all start doing?
Yeah, some low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, low-hanging
fruit.
Whether
it's like diet,
about
light
sleep
at night.
Or diet or exercise, right. Or things that you could, that they might not have thought of.
Right. Yeah, so certainly the minimally processed diet, I think, is like, that's as complicated as it needs to be. Yeah, that's where you start, right? So think about what you eat for breakfast, you know, a bunch of cereal that's highly refined carbohydrates with some vitamins and minerals added back afterwards. You think it's like got those things in. Well, no, not normally. They just added those. It's like having a multivitamin in your cornflakes. So where would have these things come from in nature? Like, where do you find vitamin B12 in nature? Like, just think about where those things are coming from in nature. And then...
Yeah, we'll go on then.
Animal yes. foods.
Okay, right.
For the most part. I mean, if you eat liver and oysters, you're basically done. Like, just eat those periodically. And micronutrition, the problem just goes away. I mean, there's some things like magnesium and folate that come predominantly from plant foods. So you should probably eat some of those sometimes, right? But for the most part, it's animal foods. And I think that was... part of my problem personally was that I was trying to be a vegetarian for reasons unrelated to micronutrition. You just can't ignore basic human requirements just because you've got some political agenda or, you know, so you just can't do that. So I think that's super duper important. And then circadian rhythm, like I think is also, so there's all these things that entrain circadian rhythm. They've got this fancy word Zeitgeber, which is just like a German word for giver of time. And the main one is light and dark, right? So like I said, we've been living under the same light dark cycle for millions of years. And then how long ago is it? 200 years ago, maybe there was electric lighting, right? And you could work all through the night and you could do stuff at night that you would normally not be able to do because you'd be asleep. And before that, we only had light that came from fires and candles and that was it. And so that has had a huge impact on our biology. And I feel like that is a really important thing, like understanding the effect. So, I mean, all you really need to worry about is getting enough light during the day, especially in the early part of the day. It's super easy here in San Diego, even in February, because that's what's entraining circadian rhythm. So it's just like photoreceptors in the eye that's like in training. So it's like, because you think about it, like the brain is not normally running on a like clockwork on a perfect 24-hour cycle. It's like sometimes a bit long, sometimes a bit short. And so you need something to, that's where this word entrain comes from, right? Like it's the cycle's almost there, but I just need a little cue just to give it a nudge, just to make sure it's back on that same 24-hour light dark cycle. And that's the problem, is that you can have inadequate lighting during the day, right? So I could work in an office all day, not have any exposure to the sun. And then at night, I can just go home and turn on all the electric lights. And so then I'm getting inappropriate light cues. And I think that's having a huge effect on people's sleep. And you may not even know. And so it's like a zero risk intervention to try that, right? Like,
so do you then recommend having no artificial light after sundown, or?
Yeah, if you can. I mean, that's what we do at home. And again, it's not
so
like,
isn't it like
thinking,
pitch black in your house at
it
7
is pretty
PM.
Dark. It is pretty dark. Yeah.
It was pretty funny when we were up there visiting. I'm all, Si, where are you? And it was like 5:30 at night.
It's great, yeah. This, but I've got 12 stitches in my knee now.
You do have to watch it. Yeah, I agree. I think part of the problem is people don't realize that you have pupils and they like change in diameter. Like, so you just like let them get used to it. I mean, when you first turn off a really bright light and it's dark, like sure, you can't see shit. And if you keep moving, you're going to hurt yourself when you bang into something. But if you let your eyes adjust, you can see much better in the dark, you know?
It can be simple, like not looking at your computer beyond 6:30
or even more simple than that. Just install f.lux or Night Shift on the Apple iOS and on your Mac.
So what's f.lux?
So all it does is it changes the color temperature of your computer display. So your biology is responding to very specific wavelengths of light. And it's the blue that is like the kind of stimulating, that's daytime. And then red, like, so you think about firelight, like that is not going to suppress the production of this hormone melatonin. It's like sends a cue to your brain, oh, this is nighttime. You can suppress that with blue light. That's the problem. So if you can install f.lux, which just filters out all the blue light on your display, like that's not going to
interfere. Okay, so that's, so most computers and phones now I've seen,
they have
blue light filters.
It's a really fairly recent invention. And so when you look at your screen, it's going to look red like firelight at night,
So we should all be using blue light.
I think so. But I mean, we know that there's some data on this, that there's less of an effect if you get appropriate daylight during the day. So that's the perfect storm, is when you're not getting any light during the day and then you're exposing yourself to a bunch of light at night. That's when the really bad stuff starts to happen. And then also, you know, we know from Sachin Panda's work, we've interviewed him for the podcast, that inappropriate food timing. So when in the absence of normal light cues, food timing becomes more important, right? So that's why, you know, the old adage, eat breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince, I believe, dinner like a pauper. It's true. You should be shooting for a big breakfast. And that again is a Zeitgeber, right? It's telling your body, oh, this is daytime, right? Versus having the majority of your, I mean, that's what I would do when I was training 20 hours a week is I'd get home from a big ride and then I'd eat, you know, however many thousand calories in one sitting. And so you're sending this massive cue, oh, this is daytime. And it's not, it's 8 o'clock at night. And then that's going to have an impact on your sleep, which is going to affect your recovery, which is going to affect everything.
I'm going to continue to ask like simple questions because my head works. But so, eating late at night, a big meal late at night, I thought that was sort of, you know, is a bit of a myth now about.
Well, that depends. That's for weight loss, weight gain, all that kind of stuff. But I think, I think Chris is talking maybe.
I think that the literature on early time restricted feeding is pretty solid at this point.
So what would be the sort of general recommendations not to eat within a certain number of hours of bedtime?
Well, what most people do is they've got a 12-hour eating window. So you get up at 7 o'clock in the morning. Most people are eating from 7 o'clock in the morning all the way through to 7 o'clock at night.
Right.
And as you know, Simon, willpower tends to become depleted later in the day.
Yeah.
And so that's when the Häagen-Dazs ice cream comes out. That's when all the wine comes out. That's when all the bad choices happen is later on in the day. And also if people have been restricting calories earlier in the day, they tend to be hungrier later on, right? It's like, I've been starving all day. I haven't had been rushed off my feet. I didn't have time to eat. And so now people just compensate for that in the later part of the day. And so just being really conscious and deliberate, trying to get in a decent sized breakfast, I think can be really helpful. Yeah. And I can, you know, I think there's data up the wazoo on this now that they measure all kinds of qualitative things like insulin and glucose and all this kind of stuff. And they do see improvements. And all they're doing is restricting the feeding window so that you're eating from like 6 till 2 o'clock in the afternoon or something like that. And then kneel by mouth after that until you go to bed and then you cycle. And they're not restricting calories or anything like that. So you're not, you know,
there's nothing different about metabolism other than slowing down that about in terms of, okay, you go from upright to supine and
right.
You get, maybe get acid reflux or something by you've just eaten.
No, but, I think that's what Sachin Panda's work has shown is that there is differences in metabolism.
And Sachin Panda is who?
He's a scientist that's published he has a book. What's it called? My Circadian Clock or something like that? I forget what it's called. But yeah, he has a new book out that was out last year, I think, where he goes into all this stuff in detail. But yeah, he's got a bunch of experiments. He's got an app as well. That's where I think a bunch of his data came from in the beginning, is people were recording what they were eating. And then without putting in the time, like if you log a piece of, oh, I just ate this, then the timestamp is there, right? And you're probably not going to mess with that. And so that like a bunch of his data has come just from citizen scientists.
But I think what's fascinating to see, though, is all of those changes you're talking about and the way that you live your life is very different from the way that most of our friends or people that we know live their lives. And so it's incredibly overwhelming to even, you know, when we step in the door, say, for example, in your house, there's, you know, you store food mainly in glass rather than plastic.
Right.
So you're not exposed to toxins. All of your cleaning products are sort of toxin free or the best that you can do.
I'm sitting in the dark with a glass of water.
I
want to sit in front of the telly with a glass of wine.
Where you plug in, you turn on and off your Wi-Fi at night because of how it interacts with the system. You sleep with the kids in the same bed. I mean, there's so many different aspects. And I think it would just blow people's minds, you know, just to see how many changes that you've made and what that sort of life looks like. You know, I mean, even just talking about intermittent fasting or... Yeah, just stuff that seems so simple to you is a massive
really
aha,
hard.
Or like, wow, for
yeah, so it just becomes, I mean, it's like any hard problem that you work on. I mean, people are used to working on big problems like that in their professional lives all the time. It's like, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time, right? Like, you just need to break it down.
Yeah.
And it's super helpful, I think, to have someone to work with on these types of problems. And the best type of person in my experience is like someone that's just been through this 6 months ago, you know, like they're super good at like telling you, oh yeah, I had that thing. Like, you need to look at this brand, not that brand, or do this thing, not that. Oh, and this is what's going to go wrong next, is because that the same thing happened. Like, that's super useful, I think, to have a teacher.
But in the spirit of small steps, I think it's probably unrealistic again to expect people to be sitting in the dark and not drinking. Because that sounds so much fun. That sounds miserable, yeah. But I lived to 97, yeah. But I know I'm being a bit facetious. But in terms of an overall strategy, and maybe this is talking from my perspective, I don't want to give up some of those things. But I do, for example, shifting in terms of, okay, front loading, having a bigger breakfast, a medium-sized lunch and a smaller dinner, and trying to not eat past 7 o'clock is a strategy certainly that I could
doable.
Yeah, more doable. But
I think the point here is that the athletes, the people that we're coaching that were around, I think are starting to not feel good. They're struggling with anxiety, depression, fatigue, all of the symptoms we've spoken about.
Right.
They don't really understand that they feel that way, that that is not normal and that they can do something about it. And then educating themselves on what it might be, the cause of that, and then how to change. Mm-hmm. So there's a step-by-step sequence to this. You know, I've spent the last, I would have said, 10 years trying to understand. Right. And we have people that come up to us, I'm really dealing with this, that, and the third, and gut issues, and, you know, where do I start? And I'm thinking, oh my God,
it's overwhelming. Yeah. It's like, you're asking me a question that's taken me 10 years to answer.
Yeah, right. And I'm still not at the bottom of it. But, you know, I guess education is a huge
good place to
start.
Yeah,
yeah.
And there's a lot of great health and fitness podcasts out there now, I think. That was kind of how I got into it, really, just listening to podcasts.
Yeah.
Who are some of your sort of go-to podcasts? Obviously, yours is really popular, and I've enjoyed a variety of guests on the Nourish, Balance, Thrive podcast.
Yeah, for me in the early days, it was Rob Wolf was like one of the main ones that I found back. That doesn't exist anymore. Rob's rebranded. It was the Paleo Solution podcast, and now it's called the Healthy Rebel something or other. Like, you'd have to look up Rob Wolf podcast, you'll find it.
I know a lot of people mentioned Ben Greenfield.
So Ben Greenfield, I did listen to him in the beginning, and Ben was instrumental in launching MBT. So when I started MBT, I did that I was already working with my wife, and we were sort of thinking, well, how can we get the word out there? Like, what's the best way? And we started MBT with a local medical doctor who's also a pro mountain biker. And I've been listening to the Ben Greenfield podcast, and I thought, I wonder if you'd have us as a guest, you know? So we reached out, and we did. I did a podcast with Jamie, the medical doctor, and we told the same story that I've just talked about now. And we were inundated with athletes that were saying, you know what, I've got that same thing, the brain fog, erectile dysfunction, bloating, like whatever you did, can you just send it to me in a box? Because I really want to solve this problem. And that was great. Now, the problem with Ben is that there's just so much. He's like, I used to joke about it at the time. He's just a total fire hose of information. I would think there's no way that anybody could be doing all of this stuff. Like, this is ridiculous. And it is ridiculous. And I think that...
And he's a fairly... I mean, I know Ben. He's a fairly contentious figure in the health and fitness space.
People hate him on Twitter, right? There's definitely been some Twitter wars over
right,
there.
Right, right.
Yeah, so the question then becomes is like, well, how do you prioritize what Ben is talking about? And this is where I think the four quadrant model is so important, because it allows me to rank by order of importance all the things that Ben talks about. And... You know, people slam Ben as like a biohacker and promoting all this bad stuff. But if you listen to him carefully, if you've been listening to him for a long time, you find that he doesn't eschew the simple stuff, right? It's not like he's not talking about the quadrant one interventions, the minimally processed diet and adequate sleep and appropriate stress management, all that. He is talking about all that stuff. He just talks about a bunch more other stuff, the novel stuff. And that's where his audience is, you see. It's like you have to understand that his audience is there seeking novelty. And they want him to talk about weird stuff like injecting stem cells into his penis and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, seriously, that's the story. You can Google that. Yeah, definitely. So it's super duper weird.
But what are other podcasts that you can recommend that are good in this space for sort of getting dealing with like hard to figure out health conditions? I'll tell you one actually in my realm. Psychology or bigger existential questions is Sam Harris.
Oh, yeah.
Do you listen to Sam Harris?
Yeah, occasionally.
Podcast? If he doesn't put you to sleep.
Exactly. He's, the
he's
monotone
got,
voice
he's got a
does
voice,
bug
but
me.
The stuff that he talks about is gold.
Mm.
What does he dig into?
Mindfulness and meditation and altered states of consciousness. Recently, there's been more talk actually in the scientific world as well about the role of, for example, psychedelics, psychotherapy. Just sort of at the cutting edge of we don't yet know, but having these conversations, I find those really fascinating. He's been one of the sort of go-to guys that I've listened to for a long time.
Yeah, do you know what? If I was going to start from the beginning with the health stuff, the podcasts are not always the best place. I've just thought about this, is that because, I'm a podcast host.
It's Google, yeah. Dr. Google.
Yeah, well, it's just like, as a podcast host, you're constantly asking the question, well, how do I keep this interesting? How do I keep this moving forward? And so if you just start listening to the latest episode of the Nourish, Balance, Thrive podcast, that's probably not where you need to begin, right? And so, you know, some of the books I think are perhaps better in that regard, because they have like this linear progression.
So what sort of books have been sort of instrumental in?
It starts with Food, which is the book that goes with Whole 30, I think, was instrumental for me and continues to be for
Oh, the
clients.
Book's called It Starts With
the
Food.
The book is called It Starts With Food. Yeah. And the website is Whole 30.
Right.
It's super simple. And they have really great resources, shopping lists and meal plans and all this kind of thing. I think they're still.
It Starts With Food is a good one.
Really good. I mean, if you want to understand, like, sort of, what went wrong? I think The Story of the Human Body by Daniel Lieberman is a really good book. You know, when I talked about all this stuff regarding ancestral health and the forces that shaped the human body, like everything from the brain to the feet, and all of this stuff, like, is, I think he does a really good job of telling that. I mean, he's an anthropologist at Harvard. He's a legitimate academic, a super good guy. And he talks about these mismatched diseases, is what he calls them. And then, so most modern diseases, cardiovascular disease, some cancers, they're all mismatched diseases, meaning that 10,000 years ago, they didn't exist, right? And even in modern hunter-gatherers, you don't find these diseases. You don't find diabetes in the hunter, or very low rates. And if you do, it's because they've started to be exposed to Western diets with white flour and sugar and all the rest of it.
Right. Oh, okay. And then one that we've both read, I think you put me onto this, it's a behemoth of a book, Behave by Robert Sapolsky. This is probably one of the most influential books I've ever read. He's an is he also an anthropologist by training?
He's a neuroscientist. I think he holds three seats at Stanford.
Yeah,
I forget what they all are.
And this book is a walkthrough of really the sort of antecedents of human behavior, right? From months before you act to the milliseconds before you act, and it introduces the biology of not just sort of the neurology of behavior, the biochemistry of behavior in really fairly simple, I say fairly simple to get through, but it's been an absolute fantastic book for me,
Robert Sapolsky, I mean, one of the things he's best on is stress physiology, right? He's like, not like Sam Harris, in that Sam Harris is super good at telling you what to do about it, whereas Robert Sapolsky is mostly good at telling you about the bad things that are going to happen if you don't do something about it, right? And it's kind of... you know, the image of the businessman standing on the platform waiting for a train, and he's not wearing any pants because his hypothalamus has shriveled from exposure to all the cortisol, right? So stress makes you forgetful. Robert Sapolsky's super good for that stuff. Actually, there's a book within a book in Behave, and the book within a book is called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers.
Oh, okay. Right? Sure. Well, I mean, I know I could talk to Chris for at least another 3 minutes, but all day, because this is the stuff that you ultimately want to talk about over a beer in the dark.
I think ultimately it's about living more, right? I mean, we want to, the people that are going to be listening here want to be out there living more, and they don't really know how, given their current, whether it's state of health or being or, you know, happiness. And so it's digging deep. It's reading more, listening more, investigating, and not taking no for an answer.
Right.
And not just blindly following the doctrine of sort of maybe those around us, right?
Right. Yeah, I have a real problem with paternalistic anything, especially paternalistic medicine, right? Like, advocate.
You are, but, you know, this is contentious now.
I just think like an engineer, right? Like, that is how I got into this, was thinking like an engineer. Like, it was obvious to me that the primary care doctor was not doing a proper investigation. I saw how long you spent looking at the results of that blood test. I literally bled for that data, and you spent 6 seconds looking at it before dismissing it. You're not doing a proper investigation, and any engineer will know that. Like, they know. I mean, you think about when you get a flat tire on your bike, you want to know why you got a flat tire on your bike. You don't just shove a new tube in there and pump it up and hope for the best, because that's a recipe for another flat tire that happens about 100 yards down the road. You have to understand why that tire went flat, and that's the piece that's missing from primary care doctoring, is they don't. They move straight to the intervention.
Yeah, but I think, you know, and again, to be fair, somewhat fair to primary care medicine, it is still looking for causes of things. I don't believe it. And if you are a doctor who is only looking for a pharmaceutical treatment and not interested in the causes, I'm sure there are doctors out there like that, but they're not very good doctors. And I think most modern medicine, I've worked in a medical professor in a medical school, and I've seen that there's still, so I don't see it as much of a disagreement between sort of functional medicine and conventional medicine or whatever. I see it's a philosophy about how you get to the root of things, which is in both camps. Modern medicine, that's what it's supposed to do as well.
Right.
But I guess
I think it fails so greatly in doing that because doctors, current primary care doctors, are not educated in, they don't need to keep up with the current research. A lot of them, they don't have the time to because, I mean, shoot, one of my best friends is a primary care physician and she's into functional medicine, but she barely has a second to breathe
inside of a system.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily blaming the doctor here, I'm blaming the system.
I mean, that's one of the key findings, key learnings from working with Simon. It's not you that's the problem.
There's no bad fish, just bad barrels.
That's right. Unless, as you recently added, I thought this was very funny, unless the system is right, and then it really is you.
I think
that's definitely true. So Jamie is still working part-time as a primary care doctor, and that's the problem, is she's got 6 minutes with this patient, and they're probably going to spend the first 20 seconds saying, just write me the script, bitch. I have a hair appointment after this, right? I mean, that's not someone that's committed to make the types of diet and life changes that we've been talking about.
And those changes that are recommended, they're difficult, right? So doctors are exhausted with knowing that, and most physicians will know that.
Just do
more exercise, but they know that. But they also know that you're going to come back in 6 months' time or a year's time and not done any of those things. It's really frustrating. So the behavior change component is a real challenge.
Well, that's your biggest pet peeve, isn't it? When people are like, you know, they come up to you as a behavior change expert, you know, well, they just need to eat less.
That's right.
Or, you know, they just need to, you know, move more. What's the problem?
Oh, my God. You just got to want it. That's my favorite.
My old man says that to him a couple of times, you know. Well, I mean, you know, because he's Scottish and of course he knows everything, and he's like, well, I mean, they just do this and you just do that, and so he's sitting there going,
just
oh
do
my
it
God.
Yeah, how's that working out for you?
Anyways, on that note,
yes, well, again, that was a very long wrap up there, but we, again, proof that we could keep talking about this all night. Well, thank you, Chris, for coming down to San Diego. We're recording this in person, so, and we'll I'm sure we'll continue on after this podcast is over. So how do people find out about you?
Oh yeah, nourishbalancethrive.com. Come listen to my podcast. I enjoy a holistic look at health rather than just, one of my pet peeves with health and fitness podcasts is they tend to get very focused on a particular domain within health, and that can get a bit boring, I think.
Maffetone training.
Yeah, or, you know, any of these things. Like, if you just talk endlessly about the same thing, I don't know, maybe that's important for people that are just coming into it.
But
for me, I like looking at every component of health. And so that's what I try to do over at nourishbalancethrive.com. And yeah, thank you for you, Simon, because it was truly transformational for MBT when you came along and started talking about behavior change.
Right.
The things that you can do to, you know, if it all comes down to behavior change, well, how do you do that? Like, we can't just tell clients to change.
Yep.
And so, yeah, it was truly transformational for our business to have some tools to help our clients change, because they're not always the crazy triathlete doing 30 hours a week of training. You just need to tell them what to do and they'll just do it. Like, not everybody's like that. So
try telling those guys to rest.
That's
the same as getting them to do something.
Yeah, anything
right?
but that. Yeah, they'll do anything.
No!
Like,
rest as hard as you train. And yeah, that's usually a good strategy. That's one of Brad Stolberg's.
Yeah.
Anyway, on that note, thank you, Chris, again. And we'll hope to have you back on sometime in the future.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. And if you like what you heard, be sure to subscribe.
If you want to learn more, head over to exterraplanet.com. There you can register for your next off-road race, learn more about this podcast, and find some amazing gear. If you have questions or comments, you can email us at podcast@exterraplanet.com.
And if you're interested in learning more about how to master your brain for endurance sports, we've written a book.
It's called The Brave Athlete and is available everywhere they sell books.
And we even have an audiobook. In fact, we narrate it.
Yes, that's not exactly a great selling point.